thanks. As Simone said, this is going to some extent be a pedagogical talk. So I'm going to start by discussing the relationship between entanglement and tensor network states, most especially in one dimension, where we really understand this relationship very well. And I think this will help set up also some notation that Giffre will be using in his talk later and other talks throughout the week. Then I'll talk a little bit about two dimensions, since Giffre and Frank, I think, will be discussing their PEPs and MERA states later. I'll mostly say some words sort of about that from a topological perspective. I'll talk about some more recent numerical work with Roger Melko and collaborators trying to understand how we can measure this entanglement and understand more about entanglement in two dimensions. So, but let me start with the cases where we understand best sort of one-dimensional systems. Let's say we have a system of one dimension. So we have sort of some spins on a line, a large number of spins. And we want to write down a ground state wave function for this system. So in principle, if we write down a ground state wave function, if each of these spins have two different degrees of freedom, then if we have n spins, we have 2 to the n states, which is exploding. It grows very, very rapidly with n, and it becomes impractical to write this down. But I want to introduce some notation for how we might do this. We could say that we have a wave function psi of s1, s2, up to Sn, which just assigns a number. So each of these Si is, say, plus or minus a half. And then for each choice of those, this Si is just some complex number. And that's what a wave function is. But I want to introduce some notation, a diagrammatic notation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce some notation for drawing tensors that I'm going to use a lot. So whenever I have a circle with a bunch of lines coming out, this means it's a tensor. It just assigns a number for each choice of indices on the lines. So in this case, the lines will be value of spin 1, value of spin 2, and so on up to Sn. And this blob is just a convenient way of saying, here's this thing here. So for example, a matrix is just a tensor with 2 indices. A 3-index tensor is a tensor with 3 indices, and so on. So this is just going to be a convenient way to write down a state, to just draw it as this blob. And the reason that this will be convenient is because you start contracting tensors and putting them together in all kinds of ways. And so it gets very, very convenient to, you see, this is Giffre has been setting up his notation ahead of time for his talk. So that's going to be used in his talk. So you see there's large numbers of tensor contractions over there. So this is the simplest one. As I say, this has 2 to the n different numbers to find this tensor. Now, in order to simplify the problem, let us imagine cutting the system into two halves, the left half and the right half. Or sometimes they would be A and B, you might say. If you have any state, there's a useful thing you can do when you have a bipartite system, a left and a right half, which is called the Schmidt decomposition. So you can write the state. In general, if I have any state psi, of course, I can introduce some basis on the left and some basis on the right and say it's some state alpha on the left and some state beta on the right. These alpha and beta are just a complete basis of states in left and right, summed over alpha and beta with some coefficients A of alpha and beta. So you could always just write it in this way. But it turns out that you can find always a very nice basis on the left and on the right such that this A becomes diagonal. So we can choose a basis such that, in fact, psi is just written as a sum over A alpha, psi left alpha, psi right alpha. We can find such a basis, and this is an orthonormal basis on the two sides of the system. It's psi left alpha and psi right alpha are just completely different states. They may have nothing to do with each other. It's just we can find this basis in which this happens, and we'll normalize the state correctly so that the sum of the squares is 1.
Is it obvious that the number of states on the left is equal to the number of states? Isn't that implied by this? Or?
So the point is that the number of states we need is, in fact, the rank of this matrix. So you can think of this A alpha beta on the one hand as some coefficients on left and right, or you can say, well, it has 2 coefficients and it's a matrix. And the number of states you need is actually the rank, the number of non-zero singular vectors of this matrix. And
but one side was very big compared with the other. It basically would be the size of the smaller.
It would be the size of the smaller one, right. This is an important thing. It would be the size of the smaller one. It would mean that even though the other side was very big, we only need to keep a small number of states from that side. Yeah, thanks. Now, a useful approximation to make, and what I'm going to talk about a lot is how this turns out to be true for many physical systems, is in the case that this A alpha squared decay rapidly. So let's order them so that A of 1 is bigger than A of 2, is bigger than A of 3, or greater than or equal to. So they're decreasing. And suppose they decrease very rapidly. And for a lot of systems, this is the case. That by the time you're up to, say, for a typical gap system, you know, A of 1,000, this is just completely negligible for all practical purposes for a lot of systems you might study. Then you might want to truncate. You might want to say, well, initially this sum from A went from A going from 1 to, say, 2 to the n on 2. Why did I say 2 to the n on 2? Well, that's sort of the maximum number of states. If there were n sites, there's at most 2 to the n on 2 in each half. But let's truncate, and let's approximate this by saying it's just the sum from alpha going from 1 to k, where k is some number that we'll call the bond dimension. And the bigger k is, the better this approximation is, but at the same time, the more numerical work we'll have to do. What's that? Oh yeah, sorry, I left out the numeric value. Right. So this is an approximation that we'll make. Now I want to write down what this approximation would look like back in this language of tensors. Well, psi left alpha is actually, this is a tensor. For each alpha, I have a different state. So a state on the left side has a smaller number of indices, right? So if I had 4 on the left and 4 on the right, a state on the left side only has 4 indices. Let's put 4 up here. But then it depends upon this variable alpha. So these indices would be the physical spins going from 1 up to n on 2. And this would be this index alpha that I'm using to label the different states. And then I would stick in another tensor on the right, like that. So I have simplified the state. And if you want, well, you're going to say, well, where's this A of alpha? You know, I put the psi left here. This is really psi left of alpha. This is psi right of alpha. And you say, well, where is your A of alpha? You can either choose to sort of absorb it into one of these. That's sort of the more traditional matrix product notation. Or the notation that Giffray likes to use a lot is to sort of put it as another thing that lives right along this bond connecting the two. So there are different ways you could put the A of alpha. So you could either add in a little, replace this line connecting the two blobs with a single circle, and then this would include your A of alpha, or you could just absorb your A of alpha into one half of the other. But this approximation that I wrote down mathematically here is just exactly this approximation, taking the state and approximating it by something cut in two like that. Now, at this point, this is already some gain in the effort it takes to write the state down. Because before, I had 2 to the n states, 2 to the n different numbers defining the tensor. Now, to define the left tensor, I have k times 2 to the n over 2 to define the left tensor. That's how much it takes to define the left tensor. For each index, I need to define 2 to the n on two different states. And then I need to do twice that, because I need to define also what the right tensor is. And if n is large and k is not so large, then this is an enormous saving in the amount of space to write the state down. This already, however, would not be very useful, because it turns out to be a little bit more work to manipulate these tensors. So you wouldn't have actually really gained much just doing this. But there's no reason to stop there. You could say, well, perhaps I could decompose this left side and this right side further. So what you could do, one natural thing to do, is to imagine I did this decomposition across this line. Then you could take this state and imagine decomposing it on this line, decomposing it here, and so on. So you might approximate your psi by a state that looks like that. And then these become your physical variables. And these are called your bond variables, alpha 1, alpha 2, and so on. And this thing, which is sort of just a natural continuation, you start with this, then you realize that each of these states here for any given alpha for any alpha here, I have a state here. For each state, I can apply a new Schmidt decomposition on another bond and then make an approximation that I only need to keep the largest Schmidt coefficients. And I'll wind up with something like this. And this is called a matrix product state. This is the, yeah. Yeah, I'm sort of glossing over that a bit. What you can prove, and I'm going to allude to this in a little bit, is that if the Schmidt, what I had said is that if the Schmidt coefficients decay rapidly on one bond, then just the cut across that bond of keeping the largest Schmidt coefficients gives you a good approximation. And not only is this a good approximation, this is the best approximation with given Schmidt rank to this state. On the other hand, when we're cutting across multiple things, it would depend a bit upon the order, and the naive thing of just keeping the largest ones on each cut is not necessarily the best approximation. It'll be a good one, and it's a very easy one to find, but it's not necessarily the most optimum, because maybe by giving up a little here, you can gain a little there or something. Yeah, thanks. So this is called a matrix product state. This is the foundation, really, for the density matrix renormalization group algorithm that Steve White invented. And you might more conventionally see this. You might see, well, each of these tensors depend upon, say, this tensor here, depends upon two bond indices, alpha 1 and alpha 2, and a physical index. So one often thinks of it as a matrix that depends upon the spin variable. And then this product over all these tensors can be viewed as a multiplication of these matrices. Perhaps we should even put one more index on the matrix to indicate that each site might have a different tensor. They're not necessarily all the same, especially if the system is not translation invariant. And then you could say that this is just a product of the matrices. We have these indices, and then you could just drop the indices and say that's a product of matrices. So that's the more traditional way of writing it, to say that it's, say, A1 of S1, which is really just a vector, A2 of S2, An of Sn. I'm going to stay away from that, just because I want to put things together in other ways. But that's what you'll often see if you go read the DMRG literature or the matrix product state literature. So I have these states here. And the nice thing, yeah, question?
I feel like boundary conditions would be exactly the same.
It's a very natural thing to do, is to contract like that. This already leads to a little bit of an interesting question with the Schmidt decomposition here. We can understand very well that when we cut it here, there's sort of, well, this is what I'm going to explain, there's a limited entanglement. But now at this periodic boundary condition, kind of when you cut it here, it doesn't cut it into two disconnected pieces. You need to cut it in two places. And that's sort of the first foreshadowing of the troubles in two dimensions that arise. But the natural state to write down is this one, and then this multiplication just becomes a trace. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good point. I think this was Frank and Ignacio were the first ones to write this one down. I'm not sure about the...
I think also people like Römer and Osterlund have been done.
Okay, yeah, so this is a natural way to handle periodic boundary conditions. So I've been alluding to the fact that if these Schmidt coefficients decay rapidly, then this is a good approximation. But, you know, how do we know that these Schmidt coefficients decay rapidly? So, well, we should regard the states as, in many cases, as variational states. And variational states play a large role in physics. You have, say, the BCS variational wave function. That's where superconductivity came from. You have Laughlin's variational wave function. You have all kinds of different variational wave functions in physics. And you kind of usually want two properties for your variational wave function. They should capture the physics of the problem you're trying to study. Otherwise, why would this be a good thing to look at? But it should also be something that you can manipulate, in the sense that if I just say my variational wave function is all these, sure, every state I would want to study is contained in this, but it's too big to look at. So I want a state that I can manipulate easily. So somehow also I wanted that these states I can manipulate easily, and I'm going to discuss what it is about these states that makes it possible to efficiently determine expectation values in these states. So there's really two things that we need to do to show that these might be good states. One is to look at the entanglement, and the other is to show that they're useful. I guess other people will probably be talking about more about algorithmics, so let me just say that first, because I'll just get that out of the way in sort of 2 minutes, and then discuss the entanglement, which is more what I want to say about. So this is not, what I'm going to say for the next few minutes is not about why these might capture the physics of anything, it's just how would you actually use it to compute something. So let's go back to just say open boundary conditions, and say you're given this class of states. And how are you going to find something? Well, the first thing, if someone gives you a local Hamiltonian, the first thing you'd want to do is pick the tensors in your state. And if you're trying to find the ground state, you would want to pick the tensors in your state to minimize the energy. So you'd want to sort of minimize psi h psi, where h is your Hamiltonian. And let's correctly normalize it. We'll divide by the norm of the state, because maybe this isn't normalized, right? So we need to really, to compute h, the expectation value of the energy, we need to be able to compute the numerator and the denominator of this expression. I'm not going to explain it the way it's actually done in practice. I'm just going to explain it sort of the easiest way to explain it. You need to compute the numerator and the denominator. Then, assuming you can do that, you can start varying your tensors in order to minimize what h would be. So how do you compute your denominator? Well, to compute your denominator, this is a state. And all you do is you join it with its complex conjugate, like that. That's the tensor network expression for psi interproducted with psi. It just says you take the expression for a given value of these s1 up to sn, the wave function for a given value of s1 up to sn. You then write down this one, which is the complex conjugate, because you want the square, absolute square. And then you sum over all the different s values. And that's what connecting these indices does. So this is exactly the absolute square of psi, which is what we want to compute down here. And the nice thing is that this one, it's one-dimensional, you know, so it has width too, but it's really one-dimensional. And tensor networks in one dimension, you can just contract. You use a transfer matrix technique, and it's possible to do this in a time that's just linear in the size of the system, and a time that, well, depends polynomially on this bond dimension. So you can't make your bond dimension too large. This is where you start to see some computational effort go up as you increase your bond dimension. But it goes only polynomially with this bond dimension. That is the number of states on these bonds here. It goes only polynomially with that. If you want to evaluate this psi h psi, we'll write h as a sum of local operators. We'll write, say, h is sum over sites I, hi, comma, I plus 1. It acts on those two sites. Let's say we have a local term. And anything like this, so now we just need to evaluate this for each hi, I plus 1. Anything like this we'll see as a little tensor like that, where this is site I, this is site I plus 1. So in order to evaluate that expectation, we need to draw the same diagram, except on sites I and I plus 1, we need to insert this Hamiltonian. So again, it's a one-dimensional tensor network. And again, we can do the contraction in a time that's linear in the system size and polynomial in the bond dimension. It's a little bit more work right at this point, but just a constant amount more. So we can get the numerator and the denominator, and we can vary over the states and find a good state like that. So we can manipulate these states pretty quickly. And then any other local expectation value you can do. You can even do expectation values of two far separated operators by using this transfer matrix technique. So you can get expectation values. But still, this doesn't say why this state might be good. So as I said at the start, the reason these states might work is that these A alpha square might decay rapidly. So the error we make, even in doing this approximation, is the sum of the squares of the stuff we throw out. So I want to explain how we would estimate the sum of the squares of the stuff we throw out. So our error is sum of alpha equals k plus 1 up to, I'm just going to write infinity now. It should really be 2 to the n on 2. There's only a finite number, but I'll just write infinity because maybe we don't know how big the system is, of a alpha squared. So that's the error in what we throw out. And so we want these a alpha to decay very rapidly. Unfortunately, as I said, for many physical systems, they do. And a convenient way to measure the decay of the A alpha is not to look at these, but to look at the entanglement entropy of the system. So what is entanglement entropy? We can think of these A alpha as being a probability distribution. They're squares, that is, are a probability distribution. The sum of their squares is 1. They're all positive. And given a probability distribution, you can define an entropy. So the entropy will then just be sum over alpha minus, there's a minus sign in front, A alpha squared log of A alpha squared. This is the entropy for a given probability distribution. And I can write it in a way that looks, you know, this might at first look like it's a very basis-dependent thing, very specific to the Schmidt basis. So let me write it in a way that is not so basis-dependent. I'll let rho left be the reduced density matrix on the left half of the system. So rho left is what you get after you trace out everything on the right. And this is minus trace rho left log rho left. I'll leave that to for people to check. Yeah.
So, I mean, just a question coming back to the results. Sometimes people use DMRG for non-local.
Yes.
And
how efficient it is. You can still do this evaluation. Even if the Hamiltonian is non-local, it's not such a trouble. As long if this, say, depends upon two distinct sites, it's evaluating a correlation function of two things which are separated. And so what you can do, for example, is take this. You sort of imagine then breaking this up into a sum like that. That sum is kind of like saying, let's say I have the Heisenberg interaction S dot S. We'll split it into a sum of products SX dot times SX, SY times SY. So now we just need to have a sum of product operators. So we need to evaluate for each product operator. And then that's evaluating some correlation function, which you can still do by transfer matrix because it's still 1D. The trouble more is that when the interactions get non-local, it's less likely that this Schmidt coefficients will decay as rapidly as you want.
Do you need to increase your space?
You would often need to increase your space or maybe go to some other kind of state.
Question.
Yeah.
So here right now, you've written the error in the wave function.
Yeah.
I dropped that.
Yeah.
Well, I asked the error in, say, correlation of some local operator.
Yeah.
This also bounds that.
If we have a bound on the error in the wave function, yeah, we can get an error on the operators.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about, say, the string operator?
Well, it sort of doesn't matter, right, in the sense that if I have some wave function psi, which is the exact one, and then instead of psi, I got some psi tilde, which is very close to psi. So psi tilde minus psi is, you know, very small compared to 1. Then you can say, well, psi tilde O is what you got. You can say that that's psi o psi plus the difference that's of order psi tilde minus psi. So as long as we're close in the state, we're close in everything. We might be close in all the local operators and far in the state, but as long as we're close in the state, we're close in all the operators. So here's a completely basis independent way of writing this entropy. And this entropy is some measure of how rapidly the Schmidt coefficients decay. Just because it might be useful later, this rho left log rho left, one way to write it is, here's the wave function, here's the wave function again, the bra and the ket, and then you just go contract them like that, and then you leave these indices uncontracted. Say these are the ones on the right side and these are the ones on the left side, and that's a way of writing the density matrix rho left in terms of these diagrams.
So this entropy, should I think of this entropy as the entropy in thermodynamics? Like it allows me to define an error of time? The entropy is always growing if I take a system?
Well, in many systems, the entropy is growing. If you take a, if you, what's that?
But finance system which can.
If you take a finite system, it will return. I mean, one of the things that.
Other example other than that.
Yeah, let me get to the time dynamics of this in a bit because I want to speak a bit about the statics first. I think it does as far as we know often have a direction, but let me talk a bit about the statics and then the dynamics. It's useful to also talk about so-called Rényi entropies, and unfortunately the same index alpha is used to describe these Rényi indices. So now this alpha is a real number, while this one was an integer index. I'm just adhering to the notation that's usually used, so it's unfortunate that the two are the same. So what this is you take trace of rho left to the alpha, then you take the log of it, and then in front you put in a prefactor that's 1 over 1 minus alpha, like that. So this is called the Rényi entropy. And as you take the limit as alpha goes to 1, this becomes the same as this one called the von Neumann entropy. The Rényi entropy is nice because depending upon the alpha, it's sensitive to different parts of this probability distribution. When alpha is greater than 1, it's sensitive to the largest rho left. I mean, what it's doing is it's raising rho it's sensitive to the first Schmidt coefficients, the largest ones, because you're raising the Schmidt coefficient to a power greater than one. So if the Schmidt coefficients decay rapidly in some way, these high Schmidt coefficients, when you raise them to a high power, they're very negligible compared to these ones. Sort of the difference between them is amplified by raising it to a power. And so this is most sensitive for alpha greater than 1 to this part of the distribution. On the other hand, when we look at alpha less than 1, it gets most sensitive to the tail of the distribution. And it turns out that what you can do is, this is I think first pointed out by Verstrette and Serac, that what you can do is you can use the decay of the Schmidt coefficients for alpha less than 1 to bound, so here's this k, to bound the total norm out there. You know, I was saying we want this total norm, everything for the sum of a alpha squared for k equals, for alpha equals k plus 1 up. All this stuff, we want to bound this. We want to show that this is small. So what we need is some kind of measure that's sensitive to the value of the small Schmidt coefficients, and these Rényi entropies provide that measure. And if you can get some bound on the Rényi entropies, you can get some bound on how these decay. And I'm not going to write the exact bound down, but let me just give the thing that comes out of the exact bound, and that's also just the rule of thumb to remember. The k you need is exponential in the entropy. This should sort of be clear. It's exponential in all the entropies, because for most physical systems, they pretty much all the entropies behave the same. They have sort of a different prefactor in front, but they often have the same scaling. So there's sort of some constant up here. But the reason you need that is that the entropy of k states is just at most log k. So in order to get an entropy of s, you need k that's exponentially large. So as entropy grows, the k grows rapidly. So having a high entropy kills this scheme, because it leads to an exponentially large k. So we need the entropy not to be too large. Now, I think John Cardy is talking later a bit about entropy in conformal field theories or other systems from field theory in one dimension. People have calculated what these entropies look like in one-dimensional systems described by conformal field theory. And what you find is that at a critical point, so this is CFT. At a critical point, the entropy goes logarithmically in the system size with some prefactor that depends upon the central charge of the theory and that depends upon which particular Rényi entropy that I'm looking at. But other than that prefactor, it goes logarithmically in the system size. This isn't so bad. If the entropy goes logarithmically in the system size, that means that the k you need goes polynomially in the system size. And that's tractable. We can still handle that. So that's at the critical point. If you're a little bit away from the critical point, the entropy goes as log of the correlation length. And now this is good, because if the entropy goes as log of the correlation length, it doesn't matter how big the system is. So the system gets bigger, you cut it in two, and the entropy is still the same thing. This is the first example of what's called an area law. Why is it called an area law? It may seem a bit strange calling an area law in 1D. But the idea is that you take this one-dimensional system, you cut it in two, the entanglement between the left and the right depends only upon the one cut, where you cut it. If you cut it in multiple places, if you said, well, this is region A, but then this is also region A, then as long as this separation is large compared to the correlation length, the entropy, well, it'll be four times as big here, because there are four cuts. And you can think of those four cuts as being the total boundary area between region A and region B. So the entropy is going as the quote area in this case. So we say that a system obeys an area law if the entropy between two regions, the entanglement entropy between two regions, is just proportional to the area of the boundary separating them. This is most interesting in two dimensions or three dimensions or whatever, where you might have, say, some complicated two-dimensional region A and then some other region B, and then a system obeys an area law if the entanglement entropy is just proportional to this boundary and not depending upon anything else. So this is what you get from CFT. You can, in fact, prove that for any local Hamiltonian, so this was work I did in 2007, you can prove for any local Hamiltonian in one dimension that there is an area law, as long as you know that there is a gap. One dimension gap and bounded Hilbert space dimension on each site, you can prove an area law bound, but the bound is vastly worse than this one. So there's an interesting mathematical question, I think, of how rapidly the entropy can grow for a gapped one-dimensional system as the as the correlation length gets large or as the spectral gap gets small. This is also a divergence of this divergence here, as s is going as log 1 over the gap. in this off-critical CFT. With Daniel Gottesman, we managed to find a theory where the entanglement entropy went as 1 over the gap to the power 1/4, which is faster than logarithmic. One can prove an upper bound on the entropy, but it's still even a lot bigger than this for the gap system. As I said, there is an upper bound, but it's still a lot bigger. So it's kind of, I think, an open question how rapidly the entanglement entropy can grow as the gap gets small. But for almost all the practical systems we see, this is what happens in one dimension.
So you have these two different statements, which are all one-way statements. So
yeah.
The statement is, if you're Hamiltonian, you slow to get, and there's a quantum space that you have to carry.
Yes.
But the other way around, doesn't necessarily have an area, you don't have to have a local Hamiltonian.
Exactly.
Well, there's another statement which says, if you have a local gap Hamiltonian, then you have exponentially decaying correlation.
Yes.
So what do you know about correlation and NLs?
Okay, good. So yeah, you're giving me a whole bunch of things that I wanted to get to. So let me also remember not to remind me again, because I want to say about your non-equilibrium question, but that's a good thing. What we know about correlations and area loss, it would have seemed like there's a hand-waving argument for area loss. Here's the hand-waving argument that says it'll be log 1 over the gap, or at most 1 over the gap. Here's the hand-waving argument. The hand-waving argument says, here's our one-dimensional system. We know that the correlations are short. You can prove that the correlation length is at most 1 over the gap. So if I cut it here, and the correlation length is 1 over the gap, you say, well, so clearly it's only these degrees of freedom within the correlation length that can correlate with the stuff across here. So the entropy must be at most the correlation length, and in many cases, a lot smaller. This argument is not correct. In that the sense that it's not correct is that there exist states, they don't come from local Hamiltonians, there exist states that have short-range correlations for every local operator and yet have entanglement as big as you request. You tell me, I'll keep in every case a constant bound on the correlation length, constant bound on the Hilbert space dimension on each site, and yet I'll just put in as much entanglement as you ask for. So we don't have that one. So there's something about entanglement that's invisible to the correlations. And then another good one.
How that naive argument fails, it looks pretty good.
Well, the reason the naive argument fails is that it can be the case that what you're measuring is that an operator here and an operator here can be correlated, but an operator here and an operator out here cannot be correlated. But somehow it's a bit related to this idea of conditional mutual information, that if I know something here and I know something here, like once I know something about here, then I can get a correlation. So there can be a correlation between far apart things that's only revealed when you see what's in between. So there really is some entanglement here, but it's invisible to the local correlation.
But multi-point correlations.
Yeah. So right. So that's why it's sort of this two-point correlation. Well, the two-point could even be, you know, that you have a set here, an operator's ported on this set and on this set, but it's just one here and one here. And so they're not. It's not just that it's a single site. It could be sets of sites and sets of sites, but it's really two far apart sets of sites with a big spacing between them. But when you put in everything, when you have some completely non-local, more string-like operator, then the stuff in the middle can create entanglement between the stuff on the end. Good. So this is very good news for computing statics in one dimension. When it comes to computing dynamics in one dimension, things are worse. There's an extension, this time-dependent DMRG, or Giffre Vidal, who really started this TEBD algorithm, where you use these states to describe dynamics of one-dimensional systems evolving out of equilibrium. And so maybe you start from some state that's the ground state of a certain Hamiltonian and has very low entanglement, maybe even constant entanglement. But then you change the entanglement. I guess they talk about doing these experiments in optical lattices, but I don't think there really is yet a good measure of such a thing. But say you started in a certain Hamiltonian. Maybe it's even just, it's a transverse field Ising model, for example, and you start with a magnetic field that points all the spins in one direction, and then you change to some other value of magnetic field, transverse field, or whatever, so that it can start to evolve out of equilibrium. So you make a sudden change in the Hamiltonian everywhere. If you do this kind of experiment, the entanglement entropy grows very rapidly in all the cases we know. The entanglement entropy can grow, in fact, as fast as it can. It can grow linearly in time. So just to be clear, for example, suppose we just have you make up your favorite one-dimensional Hamiltonian. For example, you make up, say, the XXZ chain. So you have something like SXI, SXI plus 1, plus SYI, SYI plus 1, plus delta, as zi, as zi plus 1. And you started in the ground state at 1 value delta, and then you suddenly change delta to some other value. Even if you started in some very nice, you know, some very large delta where the initial state is just a pure product state, you change this delta suddenly, and what you find empirically in all cases is that the entanglement entropy grows proportional to time. And this is very bad news, because if the entanglement entropy grows proportional to time, then the k we need is going to grow exponentially in time. And so you can only simulate for very short time scales. In fact, there are many ways of simulating at a cost that's exponential in time. You could just simulate a small system, and as the time gets larger, you need to simulate bigger systems in order to push the boundaries further away, and again, that's exponential in time. So it's very hard to simulate things out of equilibrium. So this is what Simone was asking, that when you want to study one of these systems, there really does seem in many cases to be an arrow of time. The entropy is growing up linearly in time. There's a reason why we expect to go to such a high entropy. The reason is, so let's say we have some given value of delta, say delta naught for t less than 0, and some delta 1 for t greater than 0, and they're different. The ground state of this Hamiltonian is some mix of very excited states of this Hamiltonian, some superposition of very excited states of this Hamiltonian. It has an energy density that's of order 1. You've changed the energy density, you've changed the energy everywhere. You can just go take the ground state of this Hamiltonian, compute its expectation value on that one, you see it has a very high energy. So if it comes to a thermal equilibrium, which is a natural thing to think, if it comes to a thermal equilibrium, then it's coming to thermal equilibrium at a temperature of order 1. And so, well, in thermal equilibrium, you should see mixed states. Of course, my whole system is in a pure state. So what does it mean I see mixed states? I can look locally, and locally, I can see a mixed state. But the entanglement entropy I see locally now is the thermal entropy. The two are one and the same. The entanglement entropy and the thermal entropy are one and the same. But we know if it's at a non-zero temperature, there's an entropy density. So the entropy is, in thermal equilibrium, is proportional to the length. So we expect that, in this case, the entanglement entropy will grow until it becomes of order the length. And the way it grows there seems to be as fast as it can. So you have a case where the entanglement and the thermal are really the same and very large.
If I look at the mutual information, then of course it would fulfill the earlier
one. No. I mean, what's happening is, depends which mutual information you look at, right? If you look in thermal, this is a case where you see a difference. If you look truly in thermal equilibrium between two regions A and B, it fulfills an area law. On the other hand, if you actually go compute it, we know that the whole system here is in a pure state, because I started in a pure state. So it doesn't fulfill an area law. It's very far away. The reason is that it's only when I make local measures that I can see that. Whereas if you compute the entropy of the entire system, there you see the difference. The whole system has zero entropy. Yeah, Frank.
Does that actually suggest that the right way to do this time evolution would be to work on mixed states?
Well,
because then you could really use.
Perhaps. I mean,
you would have an extensive kind of entropy.
Perhaps. You may need a way to, to somehow find the right mixed state to truncate to. The trouble is that these algorithms sort of don't seem to know which state to go to when they start to make an error. I like our folding method, but.
Somehow it kind of works
with mixed state.
It's proportional to the volume is somehow something simple because it's thermalization.
I know. So this is the funny thing, right? It's like at early times this problem is easy because all it does is it's not yet entangled. But once it's entangled, if you look locally, not only is it a thermal state, it's a thermal state at a large temperature. You know, temperature 1. I mean, far away from any critical behavior or anything. So it should also be easy. So yeah, it's, in a sense, it's just a crossover problem. But to figure out how to go from one representation where the tensor should be one way, and then another representation where it should be mixed states, we don't know how to do that in a good way yet. So I like the folding method we have, but probably there are better things. So that's sort of one approach, but probably there are better things to do. So this is all one dimension. So now what happens when you get to two dimensions? I think I've covered most of the things on one dimension.
Here you have an integrable system. So
oh, yeah, it's if you do. So,
special feature.
Oh, well, so we've done some non-integrable system also. So we did like Ising with transverse plus parallel field. And you also see the same kind of rapid growth. The main way that I see the integrability there is often that if you do a simulation on a finite size system, in the integrable case, you see some different recurrence. The recurrence time seems to be much shorter. But otherwise, there doesn't seem to be.
So you're saying as long as you're interested in the growing of the entropy with time, there's no difference?
That's the same.
Stabilization, that's all.
Yeah, and the other thing is in the integrable, you should not be going to just the, since you have additional local conserved quantities, whatever ensemble you go to should be consistent with those, so there should be some sort of field conjugate to everything that's conserved. I mean, so the most obvious one is just total SZ should be conserved, but then since it's integrable, there will be others, so there would be, say, a magnetic field conjugate to SZ. So now let me talk a bit about two dimensions. When you go into a two-dimensional system, you can start to draw similar things. The trouble is this kind of way of building up the system by saying I'm going to cut it in two by cutting it at one thing doesn't work so well. You can't just cut one bond and cut it in two. So what can you do if you have a two-dimensional system? Well, one thing you could do, the old DMRG thing, is you treat the two-dimensional system as a one-dimensional system with long-range interactions. So you arrange, you sort of have a snake going back and forth like that, and you make it a 1D system. But now this interaction here, which is nearest neighbor in 2D, becomes long-range interaction once you view it as a 1D system. So that's one way of going, but you're ignoring some of the two-dimensionality. Another thing, due to Verstraete and Surak, is called PEPS, projected entangled pair state. They said, well, we'll sort of write down the natural generalization of the tensor network. So these indices coming out here are the physical indices. And these indices are the bond indices. And this will be the class of states that I consider. It's a nice class of states in that it's very compact. It seems to respect what we know about the higher dimensional states. It has one big downside, though, which is that contraction, you know, I said over here, I was illustrating how you can do contraction of this 1D tensor network. You can exactly contract the 1D tensor network. Here, though, if I want to compute the normalization of the state, what I need to do is put another tensor network for the ket on top. And now I'm left with some two-dimensional tensor network to contract to get the norm of the state. And I don't have a good way to contract two-dimensional tensor networks exactly. So Verstraete and Surak had a very beautiful idea, which was that they said, well, this two-dimensional tensor network, in order to contract it, let's think back to what we were doing for one-dimensional quantum systems. A one-dimensional quantum system, it is the evolution of it can be thought of as evolving in imaginary time, and the ground state is the largest eigenvector of the transfer matrix corresponding to evolving in imaginary time. So they say, well, we'll single out a particular direction here, and we'll evolve in that direction to contract this tensor network. And what we'll do is we'll have vectors that are one-dimensional now, and we'll represent them with matrix product states. So they had this recursive way. Now, that contraction is approximate, but that approximation may be very good, assuming that the matrix product way of contracting this 2D tensor network works. So it's sort of by analogy that matrix product states are ground states of Hamiltonians, but they're an approximate way to contract the 2D network, so you can do that. And I think there may be something very interesting to explore there sort of from a topological viewpoint, because this idea that they start with a state in one dimension, or say in two dimensions, in a given dimension, say two dimensions, what they really start with is a tensor network in three dimensions, which was this path integral for this 2 plus 1 dimensional system. Then they said, well, we're going to approximate the ground state of that by a two-dimensional network. But then, in order to contract that two-dimensional network, they thought of this as some two-dimensional tensor network and found its largest eigenstate is a 1D thing. So they keep descending one dimension at a time. And it reminds me, sort of in this study of non-interacting Hamiltonians, this Bott periodicity, that you can sort of write down a system in one dimension with one symmetry class as one in a different dimension with a different symmetry class. So there may be some way of trying to use this way of dropping dimension to get some characterization of the classes of these interacting systems.
In a less highbrow way, is what you're saying just iterated transfer matrix?
Yeah, they keep iterating the transfer matrix, exactly. They keep going down one at a time. The trouble is the bond dimension keeps going up as they do it. So they start with a given bond dimension, but then they, you know, this bond dimension is the square of that one, but then in order to, because you have this and this R1 index, and then in order to evolve, you need an even bigger one. So the trouble is the bond dimension blows up. So if you were trying to do 3, it would sort of be ridiculous to do 3 plus 1.
But don't we know there are complexity issues that are going to thwart these schemes to a certain extent?
Well, so there's a hope that the point is that there's a hope that this is not a worst case tensor network, that whatever, you know, the original Hamiltonian has some locality so that the ground state should inherit some properties that make this also have a nice property. So that's the hope. I mean, we don't know anything. The trouble is that in 2D we don't know anything about. In 1D we can really start from some stuff we know and prove something about that this state will work. In 2D we just can make some arguments. There's another very nice class of states that Giffray will talk about, these Meres states. These Meres states are another kind of tensor network. Here he's drawn, this is from his next talk that follows, a one-dimensional system, and he has some kind of branching structure where things join and split and so on. And you could repeat that same branching structure in two dimensions. The reason that these states can be contracted efficiently is not that is depends very much on the choice of the tensors that have been chosen in the state. If you just wrote down those states with arbitrary tensors, those tensors on those circles were completely arbitrary, there would be no efficient way to contract it. However, the particular choice that Giffray has made, I guess I'd better not draw anything over it because he was making this beforehand, is that these tensors are in fact chosen to be unitaries. These ones here are unitaries, and some of these ones where the number of bonds decrease are chosen to be isometries, so that when you take the state and you flip it over, most of the tensors just drop out. You use the U dagger U as identity, so you can just drop out lots of tensors that are unitaries, and this makes it possible to efficiently contract the state. So that's another useful class of states to study in two dimensions. There is an interesting topological reason also to consider both these PEPs and MERA, that both of them are capable of describing topologically ordered states in 2D, which is sort of an interesting thing. See, this one-dimensional matrix product state, you can also think of it as some sort of quantum circuit. That what you do is you start with entanglement across this bond with this bond variable. You imagine that this bond variable has some real physical meaning, and this bond variable has some real physical meaning. So you start with a state which is just entangled across the bond, and then you apply projectors on the site that say, I'm going to take the two bond variables and project it to a given physical state. So what it is it's starting with some product state and then applying some projectors, applying a local but non-unitary quantum circuit to that state. And this projected entangled pair state, they have the same idea in two dimensions. That's why it's called projected entangled pair. So the interesting thing is it's a local quantum circuit, but a non-unitary one. The MERA over here is a unitary quantum circuit. I said these were all unitaries, but it has some non-locality because of how things branch. And as you move up, this will be a lot in the next talk, things sort of the link scale increases rapidly. So one is a local but non-unitary circuit. The other is a unitary but non-local circuit. And that's, in each case, just enough to describe topologically ordered states in 2D. If they had been local and unitary, they wouldn't have been able to do it. But each scheme found a way to describe it. And it has been shown that many of the interesting states can be described in these schemes. So I just have a...
Why was it non-unitary? Where does it come from?
This one?
Yeah.
This is essentially a projection. So the example you probably know, like the AKLT chain. The AKLT chain, the bond variables have spin a half, and you take two spin a halves and you project it into spin one and you throw out the spin zero. So that's, yeah. I keep saying we don't know, though. I mean, because these are two-dimensional systems, we don't have a good way of saying, given entanglement across this cut, we can show that this state is good. So the last few things I'll talk about are exploring entanglement in two dimensions. I think we need to know more than entanglement in two dimensions. I think we need to look at other properties like conditional mutual information and so on. But let's, you know, try to explore entanglement in two dimensions. And the last thing I'll just take 5 minutes to say is we're doing some recent work with Melko and Callan and Gonzalez and company numerically measuring entanglement in two dimensions. So how do you numerically compute these things? Because we want to see, okay, do we get area laws in two dimensions? Are there known to be some interesting corrections from field theory? Can we see those and use those as a probe of the state? So over here I drew this tensor network. So suppose I want to compute S2. S2, I need to compute trace rho squared over here. So let me not draw so many lines. Let me just draw one line for region A and one line for region B. So what I would do is I would take this to there, and that gives me rho and A. And then in order to compute the trace, I go and stick in some more blobs. And that is trace rho A squared, written as a tensor network. So how do I compute this? Well, one way to do it is, this is supposed to be the ground state. This is the bra and the ket for the ground state. If I'm doing imaginary time quantum Monte Carlo, I can get the projector onto the ground state by taking this and replacing it with some other tensor network that describes a path integral over imaginary time. And I can replace this also with some other tensor network that describes a path integral over imaginary time. So what I'm left with is a path integral over imaginary time. And in region A, it just sort of goes through. It continues. And it looks like it has a certain periodicity. But in region B, it connects here and here. And there's sort of a defect point right at the boundary between region A and region B. So you can do this. And one thing we've been doing is computing this trace rho squared. And we've been doing it by using quantum Monte Carlo to get this partition function. To get the partition function, you actually need to integrate down in temperature, reduce the temperature, and reduce the temperature, and so on. Another scheme we used is a scheme of working directly at zero temperature. And then you use a projector method, and you need to do some important sampling. Because if you just directly evaluate the tensor network, the expectation value is so small that your Monte Carlo never exceeds it. So you need to do some ratio sampling to sample it right. So it's possible to do this. And what we see is that first thing, which was pretty much already known, but it's really nice to see numerically it was already expected. There are lots of gapless systems in 2D which actually obey area laws. So you can see this exactly in some gapless free boson systems where you can exactly do the calculation. But just because something is gapless in 2D, that doesn't mean you're going to see a violation of the area law. So this already tells you that the entanglement entropy in 2D is not such a sharp quantity. Why does it see an area law? Let me draw some picture. So in 1D, here's your 1D line. And what you have is you have sort of entanglement at each length scale if it's at an RG fixed point. So there's sort of, just imagine that there's some modes at length scale 1 in the system. And you know, just sort of some very local fluctuations. And then there's also some modes at twice the length scale. So this is sort of intended to be a heuristic renormalization group picture. And in accordance with a lot of ideas, we imagine there's just sort of a constant amount of entanglement at each scale. And then a smaller number of modes at a larger length scale, and so on. Actually, this is exactly where it comes from in the mirror if you compute the entanglement. And if you compute the total entanglement across the cut, you get one mode crossing at length 1 plus 1 at length 2 plus, and so on, one mode at length L, which gives you a log of L. If you go repeat this same exercise for a 2D system, you say, well, I have all these modes at length 1. I'm not going to draw it all the way around. Then I have a smaller number of modes at length 2, and so on. And I'm not going to draw it all the way around. And so you'd say, well, there's L modes at length 1 plus L over 2 at length 2, and so on. And that's 2L. So it still obeys an area law. There's long distance entanglement, but if you just measure the entanglement entropy, you're not sensitive to that. And so we see, in fact, if you look at the Heisenberg model, for example, which has gapless modes, it has gapless modes associated with spin waves, the ordered 2D Heisenberg model, you see that there appears to be an area law. Now, there are other more sensitive measures you can make other than this. For example, you can look at lots of interesting corrections. So there's this topological entanglement entropy, and now just starting to be some measurements of that. And you can look at other subleading corrections to this, which perhaps people will be speaking about. Maybe Shinsei probably will be talking about this kind of stuff later in the week. So there's expected to be a lot of other things, and we're getting results on these other subleading corrections. And I don't want to, I guess I'm almost out of time. So I'll just say that the moral is that the entanglement entropy itself isn't everything, but there are expected to be some non-universal properties. And that by using some of these ideas, it seems even that we can now start to numerically measure it. And maybe this will provide some new probes of strongly interacting two-dimensional theories. So I'll stop here. Thanks.
Okay. So could it be that you see an area law for this Remini 2 entropy, but if you would calculate the von Neumann entropy, it would really, you would have logarithmic corrections, or you don't expect that?
We don't expect that. I mean, probably we can make up a system where it happens, but as far as we know, it doesn't happen. For, you know, sort of the multiple different ways of considering it all suggest that for most normal theories, that wouldn't happen. If you, I mean, for also, we were able to get the von Neumann one to some extent in this, because there were some DMRG calculations that Ivan Gonzalez did, so it was possible to get the von Neumann correction that way, and see also that that obeyed an area law up to a more limited size.
Is this something to understand entanglement entropy of fermions, L log L, using this RG?
Oh, yeah, well, the thing is fermions aren't in RG fixed points. So kind of what happens is, yeah, I mean, their fermions are not in RG fixed point. And a way to see why fermions are not in RG fixed point is, think about a system with a Fermi surface in two dimensions, right? So sort of here's your filled Fermi C, all these points. And imagine you look at a length scale L. If you look at a length scale L, then there's sort of order L squared sites in that. But also when you look at a length scale L, you start to resolve energies of order 1 over L. And an energy of 1 over L means, OK, the stuff that is left to take care of is kind of some thin shell around the Fermi surface of a width 1 over L. And so you get something like L squared times 1 over L, which is proportional to L. So there's sort of more and more modes as you look at longer and longer scales. So it's not an RG fixed point. If you repeat this exercise for a Dirac cone in two dimensions, you'll find that you get L squared times 1 over L squared, which is 1 over 1. So that is a fixed point. And I guess actually Glenn is probably going to talk about some of this in his talk later, how you can get the L log L out of something.
What does it mean? I thought every phase of matter is an RG fixed point. Every stable phase of matter.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, in a sense, what it means is that maybe this curvature is important, right? Because the fixed point sort of has, maybe the curvature is sort of dangerously irrelevant in some way. I don't really know a good explanation, but I mean, it is a fixed point, but it's a fixed point in which this curvature is going to zero, which means that sort of when you look right at the fixed point, you have this infinitely flat Fermi surface, which means you have this sort of infinite degeneracy to translate along the Fermi surface, which gives you some enormous correction. And that's kind of what you're seeing, I guess.
Well, if you go to very high dimensions, again, the thing should simplify because I don't know.
Yeah, mean field theory.
Other than any bounds that are known, I don't know, you mentioned four.
No, I don't know any. There are kinds of bounds. Well, I wish I could remember what this result is called. There's kind of a result to the effect that if you have a density matrix in multiple variables, and it's permutation invariant under the variables.
Definitely.
That's I knew someone would know the name of it. Then it's sort of it isn't maybe Ignacio remembers the exact statement, but there's some way in which it's close to being a product. So I think that can be a formal way to justify the mean field theory off in infinite dimensions. I don't know about four or five what should happen.
I was wondering, this comes to the point of how difficult it is to estimate contractions of tensor networks. Is it possible that you could find a lower bound from a complexity assumption, at least for states that we're describing topological phases?
Of contracting this tensor?
Well, what I'm thinking is, we believe that BQP is stronger than BPP. So if we had a very good classical way of analyzing evolution of wave functions when we braided quasi-particles, if we could use tensor networks very efficiently, presumably we could collapse the computational hierarchy.
Right. My feeling is that all these ones that involve braiding, you're often naturally talking about a time dynamics. And so this kind of tensor network, we expect maybe to be hard to contract just because, in general, all the time dynamics ones are hard. I mean, we sort of would expect on complexity assumptions that contracting a tensor network describing evolution in time would be hard. The funny thing is that not only is it hard in the case where you tune the Hamiltonian carefully, it's even hard in the case where you do this just completely dumb thing of just changing the delta from one value to another. We don't even know how to do that.
You don't really have to braid things. I mean, if you can estimate projectors, that's enough.
I guess, when you start estimating projectors, though, you're doing this, I think the expectation value that you're interested in is after a long sequence of projectors. And sure, if a projector fails, then you need to do another projector and come back. And so I think what's happening is that the expectation value you're interested in is buried in something that's exponentially small in norm, and so you're going to miss that. So my feeling is that a lot of physical states, we will be able to do this contraction efficiently, but and it doesn't seem to contradict anything we know, but maybe there's a question here.
Yeah, I was wondering whether you have some example in one dimension where we have long range interaction and where the system can be gapped, for example, but the entropy can scale like the system's less. Is that possible?
If you allow me long-range interaction, it's certainly possible, because what I could do is I could just construct a state where sort of this spin is in a singlet with that spin, and this spin is in a singlet with that spin, and so on, by just adding an interaction of S dot S, and so on. If you have short-range interaction, then you need to have a small gap to have
so
this much.
Is the minimal requirement
on the
interaction?
Oh, I mean, probably one could show... I don't know. I mean, it's possible that one could show that with some kind of sufficiently fast power it can happen, maybe along some generalization of the way you show it for just local interactions. I would have to think about that one. I'm really not sure about the answer to that one, what happens with sort of power law interaction. I guess a lot of the systems with power law interaction that people consider, some of them are nice in that if it's Coulomb interaction, it doesn't seem to really be conveying much extra entanglement. And if it's something like Haldane-Shastri, it has some very nice structure to it. But I don't know in general.
Okay, so let's thank Michael for the talk.